The Tánaiste has told party colleagues that only a limited number of restrictions are likely to be eased before May. In a letter to the Fine Gael parliamentary party, Leo Varadkar also said that next month the number of vaccines administered per week would rise between 200 and 300,000. Meanwhile, the long-promised mandatory quarantine legislation has been passed by the Seanad and will now go to the President. For more, we're joined by our political correspondent, Micheál Lehane. Micheál, tell us about this letter. What does Leo Varadkar say?
Well, the Tánaiste is telling colleagues that really they have an important job to do in the next few weeks, that is to sell the message of the government's new plan for living with COVID. And he says there is no reason to be off message in that period. And I suppose crystallises clearly the government thinking about this plan and what it would mean in the short term and then over a slightly longer period, over a 10-week period. And some point before April 5th, it's expected there would be a meeting that could consider changes from that date onwards, that is from April 5th onwards, and that is contingent on two things: on case numbers continuing to fall and then pressure on hospitals continuing to ease as well. But you could see restrictions eased around the 5 kilometre rule, also around outdoor activity, and when it comes to the return of construction and click and collect for non-essential retail, that could all happen at some point to get underway then on April 5th. But no further easing of restrictions was the Tánaiste's message to colleagues beyond that, that that would have to wait until late April or early May, the slightly longer focus. I suppose all that coming against the backdrop of a sense from some within government that maintaining compliance levels in the weeks ahead could pose some difficulty, and some viewing that as the biggest challenge. The Tánaiste also saying that there will be a renewed focus on things like ventilation within buildings, on antigen testing, and also on the test, trace and isolate system.
In the Seanad at the same time, you had Health Minister Stephen Donnelly again rejecting calls for the introduction of what's known as a zero COVID policy. What did he say?
Yeah, and that call repeated from the opposition again in the Seanad, just as it had been in the Dáil. And if there's one point that it seems is going to prevent any return to the type of political consensus that was there when all this happened last year, it seems to be this issue around hotel quarantine. The government now having 33 countries on a list where people coming from there into this country would have to make their way to hotel quarantine. When it gets up and running within weeks, that's going to happen, is the government promise at least. But the health minister also repeatedly asked about zero COVID, and of course mandatory hotel quarantine for all would be a central part of that. Stephen Donnelly rejecting it, saying that it is a seductive idea but that it would take a long time to happen. And he said too, even getting to the starting blocks of zero COVID would require a further, we'll say, tightening of the restrictions that are in place at the moment. He spoke about the 5 kilometre rule possibly going back to 2 kilometres, and any businesses that are open possibly having to shut, something rejected fairly strongly by the opposition and also by public health experts. But on the timing of it, he said that was the key question. How long would it take? He said it's nonsense to suggest that it could be done within 6 weeks. He said it could take from anywhere from possibly July all the way out to November, and that the schools would remain shut. So you can see this continuing to present very different views across the political spectrum and also among public health experts.
The government looking for money from the EU now under the Recovery and Resilience Fund, as it known. The country was already allocated, what was it, about €853 million. So is this a case of the government now putting in a submission to make sure that the country can draw down that money?
Yeah, the government going to formalise that submission, and they're saying the focus is going to be on areas where jobs can be created and that can also drive regional balanced development, and a focus on the digital economy and the green economy too. All that discussed last night at a meeting of a Cabinet Economic Recovery Committee, and I suppose two signs signalled there about the next step when it comes to publishing plans over the period into the summer. There will be an economic recovery plan published possibly in May or June, and also then a new and revised national development plan and a new climate action plan, all that to happen before the summer, I think, when government hope that they will be able to at that point talk about economic recovery.
Talk to us about the World Cup, Micheál. What's known about this bid?
Yes, I suppose this has been floating around for since 2018, but a significant political step forward last night with Boris Johnson, the British Prime Minister, saying that his government would financially back the bid. That's when it comes to putting together a bid that would ultimately possibly go before FIFA, and a warm reaction here from the Sports Minister and Government Chief Whip, Jack Chambers, who said that a feasibility study around the entire issue would continue in his department. You're looking at five football associations making a play now to try and host the 2030 FIFA World Cup across Ireland, Northern Ireland, and then Scotland, England and Wales. I suppose there's some distance to travel on it, but there certainly seems to be a strong commitment from the government here to back the bid. But I suppose key to all this is that an actual decision on whether to proceed or not, that's not something that has been formally taken by the football associations yet, and it will be next year before that formal bidding process would open too.
Just one final thing this morning, Micheál. Stephen Donnelly, going back to the Health Minister again, he's seeking to extend the medical cards of dependents of women affected by the cervical check controversy. Tell us about that, if you would.
Yeah, those cards for just under 1,100 people, the families of the women affected by the cervical check controversy, issued on what's termed an administrative basis in 2018 for 3 years. Now they're set to be extended for another 3 years, subject to a cabinet decision today. I suppose while that is something that would be welcomed, there have been repeated calls in the Dáil in recent time, though, to make those cards permanent for the families of the women involved as well. The women themselves have cards that don't have an expiry date, and the political call has been that that should apply to their families as well.
Micheál, as always, thank you very much for joining us. Micheál Lehane there, our political correspondent.
Now, some good news this morning with a continuing fall in COVID patient numbers in hospital and in ICU. But the damage inflicted by the pandemic on patients with non-COVID illnesses awaiting appointments is laid bare in new research, which shows that the health service is heading for a waiting list of almost 1 million. The analysis by the Irish Hospital Consultants Association also reveals that because of COVID, there will be 200,000 fewer outpatient and inpatient appointments this year. Professor Alan Irvine is president of the Irish Hospital Consultants Association. Professor Irvine, good morning.
Good morning, Mary.
This research, it really drives home the impact of COVID on what was an already challenged health service. What's the best case scenario for patients who are awaiting treatment as this year progresses now and hospitals begin that return to non-COVID care?
No, you're absolutely right. We started the pandemic in February of last year with a mismatch really between the demand for services and the capacity to provide them, and that was evident for a couple of decades before February 2020. And what's happened with the pandemic, the health system has, everyone from the senior management to the frontline, flexed, and we've been able to cope just about with the demands. But what that has done, the demands of the really urgent care that needed to happen during the three waves of the pandemic, that has displaced scheduled and time-sensitive care. And it's put a lot of extra people on the waiting lists. And unfortunately, the requirements for things like social distancing as we go into this year mean that we can't pick up to 2019 levels. We're going to be behind on our 2019 activity levels. So we really need to have a radical plan for dealing with that waiting list. We need to have a radical plan for recruiting. We've almost 730 empty consultant posts. We need to get a fresh team to join the team on the pitch that's coped very well in the last year, but we need a lot of new energy and talent coming into the system, and we need capacity and infrastructure around people to allow them to work to really make a dent in these waiting lists. Now, what I want to say on just from the patient focus, that you, the way your question was worded, we do try and prioritise letters as they come in and referrals, so that the people who have got symptoms and letters that look like they really need care in the next few weeks, that they will do that. We do our very best to make sure people don't miss out on care. But when you have, you know, coming up to 860,000 people on waiting lists, you can't do that with absolute accuracy across that number of patients. So it is difficult, and it is a risk.
is there also this factor that what was a scheduled appointment for perhaps an elective procedure is going to become chronic care, adding further to the pressure on the system at a time when, you know, healthcare is exhausted, HSE management is exhausted, and the system still has to work with restrictions?
No, well, you're absolutely right in your depiction of people have given so much in the last year. They really are on their knees, and they've responded really admirably. Your point about delay in accessing care is really well made. You know, many problems are easily solved with less intervention, with less treatment, if they're picked up early. You know, simple interventions that don't need to escalate into prolonged admissions or chemotherapy and radiotherapy, and all of the stress that places on the person who has to go through that. You know, their time away from their family and their jobs. Delayed diagnoses are something that we really want to avoid, and we can only do that safely by increasing capacity. In the meantime, we have to really try and triage as many people as we can and get the correct people to care urgently. But that's an imperfect process, and if you have a system working beyond its capacity, it's really a stressful environment. So we need to expand and recruit, and we need a really clear timeline on how we're going to do that, a really innovative way of doing that, just as we've been innovative over the last year, and we've learned a lot of new ways of working together. We need to build on that.
Indeed, and to stay with that, because would you say that over the last year you've seen a transformation in the way that elements of healthcare has worked and worked together, and can you hold on to that? We've seen change that we would have been told pre-pandemic could not possibly happen, and it has happened in months rather than years.
Well, I think you're right. We need to channel that energy and that collaborative spirit, that element of all of the elements listening to each other and forming really collaborative solutions. We need to devolve and decentralise some decision-making locally. That will really help, because a lot of the best local solutions, best solutions in the system have been local in flexing around the COVID capacity. And we need to really have a collaborative way of filling the posts with our young people, our young nurses, our young doctors, our young consultants. How are we going to bring them into the system for the next 5 and 10 years? What will
How
attract
are
them
you
in?
Going to bring them into the system? And is there an appetite now among your consultant colleagues abroad to return to the Irish healthcare system, because you have over 700 vacant consultant posts?
We have, and that's a huge concern for us. There's 3,200 of us, and we train the next generation of consultants, so we're very in tune with what our doctors, these are senior doctors in training who are looking to it through their career, looking for where they're going to spend the next 30, 35 years of the career. We know exactly what they need to come in. We're in touch with lots of people around the world as well. We have members who are interested in the position. The discriminatory pay is a huge disincentive, I have to say that. People who have been appointed since 2012 get paid less, and we're now probably the only public sector where there's such a big distinction between people who were before and after 2012. We really stand out, and that really disincentivizes people. We need to provide the infrastructure for them too. They want to come and work and be effective in a modern infrastructure with facilitated IT. The things that they see when they work overseas, you know, they want that to come to be in Ireland when they come back.
That change still has not happened. Professor Alan Irvine, President of the IHCA, thank you very much.
Age Action has urged the government to provide further supports for older people affected by the closure of bank branches. This follows the announcement by the Bank of Ireland that it's to close 103 branches in the Republic and the North. Less than a fortnight ago, Ulster Bank said it would be withdrawing from the market in the South. We can talk now to Age Action's CEO, Paddy Connolly. Good morning.
Hi, Rachel.
What's your main concern about these changes as announced yesterday?
Well, I think it further erodes the relationship between older people and their connection to the local town and street and the ability to go and do their banking. The exit of Ulster Bank, the closure of post offices over the years, and now this announcement is just another blow to diminishing older people's independence. It pushes their reliance onto families and friends, which increases the risk of financial abuse, and it just highlights the lack of inclusion of older people in the thinking when it comes to the growth of the digital economy. And this has really accelerated and deepened during COVID-19, where people have had to isolate themselves and take care of themselves, but their lack of access to online facilities, whether it's because of weak broadband or because they don't have the skills. And Eurostat would say that Ireland is well behind the EU average in terms of basic skills of people between 55 and 74.
No doubt lots of older people are happy to bank online, and if they have broadband, it's something that they can do. But as you say, there's also an assumption in all of this that everyone has access to broadband when we know that they don't.
Yeah, and we know that about 33% of people between 65 and 74 have never been online. So it's a very significant issue. And we know, you're right, that broadband is a problem. But I think there was a Digital Skills for Citizens programme which targeted people who were vulnerable to digital exclusion. And that ended in 2019. And I think it's unfortunate that the government continues not to invest and develop specific programmes for those who are vulnerable. So there is a digital strategy being developed, but it's a 10-year strategy. And that programme ended at the end of 2019. There's no sign that it's going to restart any time in 2020. So we'll have 2 years of people not being supported to get online. There is some residual funding left from the last programme, but there's no indication that the various ministers... In fact, it's fallen now between two. We understand that the digital skills programme was in the Department of Communications. It's now with education because of this digital strategy. So it doesn't seem to be even be held by any department and anyone taking responsibility for ensuring older people and vulnerable people get online.
Given the level of restrictions, though, at the moment, would it be possible to roll out a course like that?
Well, we actually have very innovative programmes where we have developed a digital skills pack kit, keep connected kit, where we provide people with a written document, a volunteer phones them, there's video clips that they can be shown by what we call digital champions, family, friends and others. So there are very innovative programmes, and that's just one of them that can support people to get online now through, as I say, we have over 400 volunteers willing to work with older people to get them online. We can send them a document and we can show them videos so families and others can use the kit to help people get online, and those types of programs need to be funded at this point.
For people who don't want to do that, would you accept that many services are now available in the post office?
Well, I think we need clarity on the relationship between banking and the post offices. And even if there are services available in post offices, we know that for many people who live in rural areas, who live in small towns, that the travel becomes
too.
Particularly... Yeah, exactly. And that's the issue, that most services, even government programmes, for example, the National Driving License Centre, you have to apply online to get an appointment for a new driving licence. Of about 10 surveys that were carried out by the government to consult with the public, only one of them was available through consultation. The rest were online. So it's not just the commercial, it's right across government that we're moving towards online working, and we're not ensuring that we're keeping the pace to protect those who are most vulnerable to exclusion.
Paddy Connolly, Age Action CEO. Thank you for joining us.
We're going to look at crime in inner city Dublin. Locals say it's on the rise. Drugs have infested communities, while knife crime and intimidation are more commonplace. Now, that's according to locals and community groups trying to tackle the issues. Cian McCormack has this report.
You're looking out your window there. What do you see?
Well, at the minute, nothing. But 90% of the time, you would see somebody selling tablets on a regular basis.
This is 70-year-old Paddy Murdiff.
Like, I'm here 16 years and I don't feel as safe as I would have last year or the year before.
He lives in Dublin's northeast inner city.
This area is absolutely brilliant. 99% of it is absolutely ace. I love living in here. It just seems to be an underlying threat is probably the best way to describe it.
Shopkeeper Darlo Callahan runs a shop on Sean McDermott Street. He's had trouble and been intimidated.
Somebody, a chancer, like somebody who comes in and they'll try to steal something, or they'll try to give you a dodgy 20, or maybe they'll ask you for change of 20 and then claim they gave you 50, you know, it'll be something small like that. if they don't know that you're not a pushover, they might start to threaten you with all sorts of ones, like, you know what I mean, your shop will be burned or you'll be shot. Or, but that's generally not local people.
Like, have you been told your shop will be burned?
Yeah, but not by a local, not by somebody from the inner city, by people who've come in here to buy their drugs or maybe sell their drugs or whatever. For me, that's where most of the trouble comes from.
Intimidation, an upsurge in knife crime, and the undercurrent of drug-related violence prompted a Zoom meeting of the North Inner City Community Coalition in recent weeks.
The coalition is a broad church representing all interests and individuals in the northeast inner city. The areas we're talking about here are around Ballybock, North Wall, Sheriff Street, Five Lamps area, Buckingham Street, Sean McDermott Street and Summerhill. For some people, it would include parts of East Wall as well.
Noel Wardick, CEO of Dublin Inner City Community Co-op, was one of the conveners of the meeting.
140 people logged in to that call with overarching sentiment expressed. It was one of sadness that a community which people love is being subjected to this level of violence and ongoing drugs-related intimidation.
Wardick says tackling poverty is a key solution.
While there has been an upsurge in crime and violence, the solution is basically you cannot arrest your way out of this problem. It is correct to say that the scale of drugs and the drug business in the northeast inner city is a scandal. And the fact that that has been allowed over many, many years to develop is completely unacceptable. And we see the consequences of that today.
In the southwest inner city, the executive director of Robert Emmett Community Development Project, Austin Campbell, agrees.
None of it happens in a vacuum. And I think that we need to understand why the crimes or why the intimidation or why these things are happening and acknowledge the link between the negative social outcomes to the crime and the antisocial behaviour.
Government has responded. It has put pilot projects in place. And in 2016, there was the Mulvey Report. Again, Noel Wardick.
The Taoiseach at the time, Enda Kenny, appointed Ciarán Mulvey to research the nature of the problems in the area. The Mulvey Report was issued. And following that, the government created the North East Inner City Task Force. And the task force has been very effective. Substantial resources have been invested.
But it hasn't been successful if you're calling a meeting amongst different community groups.
Yeah, no, what we would say is the North East Inner City has been successful as much as it can be successful. But the scale of the problem, as a result of decades and decades of neglect, these are some of the poorest communities in the country, requires vastly more resources per year. So that is the challenge.
The Minister for Justice and Garda Commissioner met last month about tackling violent crime in Dublin. A statement from the Department of Justice to this programme last night said they agreed strong community engagement and youth support services are key elements in preventing and reducing crime in any affected area, but particularly during the COVID-19 restrictions. Liz O'Connor, who works with young people in the Liberties and lives in the Oliver Bond flat, says more resources need to be found for young people, especially during the pandemic.
Well, there's an awful lot of antisocial in the whole area in the Liberties at the moment, and I think it's more prevalent now with the lockdown. The services are not, we really haven't got the services what we need to address the issues with the younger people.
So what would be a solution then?
We need more education on the likes of the petty crime and knife crime, which is on the rise all over Dublin.
Liz O'Connor, who works with young people in the Liberties, ending that report from Cian McCormack.
There's been a further decline in the number of COVID infections, albeit at a slower rate than many would have hoped for. 687 new cases were reported yesterday and a single death, which took place in January. Although, as you know, the number of deaths reported on Mondays always tends to be low. According to the 14-day figures, the highest incidence of infection is in counties Offaly, Longford, Dublin and Limerick. So 1 year into the crisis, more details are emerging about how people are coping and about our ability to live restricted lives. Joining us on the line is Professor Pete Lunn, who's head of the Behavioural Research Unit at the Economic and Social Research Institute. Good morning and welcome to the programme.
Good morning, Rachel.
A year on, what does the research tell us about our attitudes towards the restrictions? Because I suppose they have lasted for far longer than many of us would have imagined a year ago.
Yes, so if we ask people how they're feeling So if we ask them, for example, how frustrated they're feeling, how bored they're feeling, there's tracking research that's been doing this for some time, and we can see that that's steadily increased over a period of time. And if you ask a very straightforward question about how tiresome people are finding it to stick to the restrictions at the moment, on a 7-point scale, most people would give that a 5, a 6, or a 7. So clearly people are frustrated, they are bored, they are tired of the restrictions. But the crucial thing here is that just because we're feeling a particular way doesn't necessarily mean that's what's going to drive our behavior. And I think people have worried, in fact, going all the way back a year, right to a year ago, people were worried, would the public be able to stick with public health restrictions to fight this disease? And even back then, people were saying, well, maybe it was only a matter of a few weeks or a few months they'd be able to tolerate. But in fact, what we find is, if we ask people directly, what's more important, the burden of these restrictions or fighting the spread of the disease, they'll say it's preventing the spread of the disease that is more important. And as of now, all of the tracking research that we have showing whether people are sticking to the restrictions suggests that despite how they're feeling, they are sticking with it.
So we might feel tired or frustrated or lonely, but that doesn't necessarily influence our behaviour.
Exactly right. And it's precisely because, as far as we can see, people are making this trade-off in their own heads. They know that this is something that they need to endure in order that we can get the case numbers down and we can prevent the spread of the disease. So, as I said, when we ask people explicitly to make that trade-off, that's the way they make it. Now, of course, this isn't everybody. There's still a minority who are breaking the restrictions and are breaking the public health guidance. But all of our research would suggest that the overwhelming majority are still sticking with it and are doing it because they consciously are aware that this is something they've got to do to prevent the spread of the disease. So there's a real sense that if we're all going to do that, we can get these numbers further down.
How much out-and-out opposition is there to the continuation of restrictions?
Very, very little. I mean, depending exactly how you ask the question or how you phrase it, it's probably somewhere between 5 and 10% of people who sort of are taking what you might call a political stance that says this is not the right way to do this. I do not support this. And even some of those people are not necessarily breaking the restrictions, although they are clearly more likely to.
Looking at the figures, when people were asked about their behaviour, more than half of people, when the question was asked, hadn't met a single person outside of their household in the 48 hours before being contacted.
That's correct. So we have a new measure, the social activity measure that we're doing for the Department of the Taoiseach. And that measure, we ask people just in a very neutral, matter-of-fact manner what they've got up to over the last week, how many times they've left the house and where they've gone and who they've met up with and so on. I mean, obviously, it's entirely anonymous. We don't ask them the names of individuals. We just say, how many people did you meet up with and in what context and so on. And we find that just over half the population haven't met anybody outside their household within the last 48 hours. That's correct. And then there's another quarter, maybe just over, who've met just kind of one or two people, outside for a walk probably is the most likely thing. And then there's a kind of smaller group who are meeting more than three people over a 48-hour period. So we can see roughly what the distribution is. And what is particularly interesting about this is that the people who are meeting more, so the kind of one in five, roughly, who are meeting more than three people in a 48-hour period, they actually believe they're meeting fewer people than average. There's a systematic misperception. They think everybody else is more socially active than they are, even though they are actually at the high-risk end of the distribution. They're actually the people who are engaging in more risky behaviour and meeting up with more people.
Is it fair to say that we all have a tendency to be, or many of us have a tendency to believe that other people are breaking the rules, but we're doing our best? The old Welshire, we're hard-pressed in this house to keep going, but the crowd down the street, oh, their behaviour's mad.
Actually, Rachel, it's really quite extreme. So sort of 97% of us think we're being more careful than average. Now, a moment's thought tells you that cannot possibly be true. Okay. So yeah, there is that. And part of it is just a sort of basic optimism. I mean, if you ask people a lot of questions like that, you can get those kind of answers. So for example, about 90% of the population think they're safer drivers than average. Okay. So when we compare ourselves with other people, we tend to be too optimistic. But this goes across not just how many people are meeting up with, how careful people are being. We can find right across the spectrum there, if we ask people these questions, they think others are doing more than them. And the primary reason for this is probably because you can see it. The people who are staying at home and are not going out and meeting people and are being very careful and abiding by the restrictions, you don't see them because they're not out and about most of the time. They're at home and they only go out for essential purposes. So we tend to overestimate what other people are doing because it's more visible.
Isn't it important, though, that we understand that, that actually the entire country hasn't gone mad and isn't going mad on a daily basis? Because it does kind of give you more of an incentive to keep on plugging on yourself.
That's a very good point. So one of the things we know that people do is they benchmark their own behaviour by what they see others doing. We don't like to feel that we are the ones who are, as it were, extreme, or that we are the ones that are taking more risks than others. But if we don't realise that that's the case, then those kind of natural pulls on our behaviour, they might not work the way we'd want them to. So it's probably an important thing that the people who are actually meeting up with sort of, you know, 3, 4, 5 people over a 48-hour period, they need to realise they're at the high-risk end of things, and maybe that'll give them a little bit more pause for thought as we try, hopefully for the very last time, to try and really push these numbers back down. Because not only are they not necessarily benchmarking their behaviour against the correct norm around them because there's a misperception, but they also may not realise that they are the people who are at the higher-risk end. So as there are still hundreds of cases a day, it's those people who are most likely to be the cases, but they may not realise it because they may think other people are at more risk than them.
Pete Lunn, thank you very much for joining us this morning. Professor Pete Lunn there, head of the Behavioural Research Unit at the ESRI. It's 19 minutes now.
And as we've been hearing, the government is backing a proposed bid by Ireland and the UK to host the 2030 FIFA World Cup. The proposal involves a plan for the 5 football associations in Britain, Northern Ireland and the Republic to join forces to host the elite tournament. Minister for Sport, Jack Chambers, good morning.
Good morning, May.
Now, I know there's a long road ahead in this, but it is exciting that even a slice of the 2030 World Cup might visit our shores. How did the proposal idea come about? Did Boris Johnson reach out to Micheál Martin, or has it come through the football associations?
Yeah, this has been discussed now for a considerable period between the respective football associations, and there's also been contact between officials across the two governments on the feasibility of such a bid. So I think the announcement from Prime Minister Johnson last night is really positive. It shows that the British government is embracing this, and the Irish government will also embrace this in a really positive way. We have a huge footballing community in Ireland, and I think the fact that the strength of the five nations and the five football associations coming together to try and work and collaborate on the feasibility of such a bid is really important. So this year we'll progress significant work on the whole feasibility process, and then FIFA next year would open the process for any submission of a bid, which can be submitted between 2022 and 2024. So we are at an early stage of this process, but the fact that we have an ambition across the two islands to try and work together to bring the biggest football, one of the biggest tournaments in the world to our shores, I think is really positive. And we'll do everything we can to work with the different football associations and the British government to try and advance this in a really positive way.
Okay, I appreciate it. It's early days and it is the Centenary World Cup, so the competition will be pretty fierce. Feasibility, of course, costs money. So what is the government putting up?
Yeah, so just say we have a major events division in the Department of Sport, which emanated from the bid which was made for the Rugby World Cup, which you'll know about. So we had a budget allocated of €6 million in last year for this, and we'll be purposing a significant amount of that into our engagement and collaboration with the British government. The exact amount that's required in terms of the feasibility process still is being worked through, but we won't be found wanting when it comes to putting our best foot forward in the whole feasibility and viability process of this bid. I think it's something that we can be incredibly positive about. We've obviously significant experience from the Rugby World Cup bid, and we also work with the football associations in trying to work out the logistics, the economic benefits, and trying to bring something of this scale to our shores.
Okay, and early days, but what would you envisage here? It'll be an All-Ireland event, and you would want to take it out of Dublin, where you'd have the Aviva and you'd have Croke Park, but significant stadiums in Cork with Páirc Uí Chaoimh, in Limerick as well with the Gaelic Grounds and Thomond Park.
That's right, and we'd need obviously significant cooperation, and there is great cooperation anyway between the different governing bodies of sport, and that's why, as I've said, the feasibility process is so important. You have to work through the various stadia. You also have to bring regional benefits to such a bid. I think all towns and cities across north, south will want to have an input and an involvement in this. And so that's the type of work now that will be ongoing. As I said, we have time on our side for this to progress and advance the detail behind the feasibility work. And you've mentioned some of the stadia there, and that's the type of work now that will have to be go through detailed feasibility, as well as working with the British government on what stadia they'll be putting forward.
Would you be confident that the FAI, with all of the problems it has had over the last year, is in a position to push forward with this?
Well, in fairness, the FAI, they're progressing a lot of governance and organisational reforms. They have a fresh start now, and we've had a very positive relationship with them, certainly since I've entered office. And I think from a, you know, the footballing family want to see both the FAI and the Irish government bring and attempt to bring such a major event to our shores. And I think they have the capacity, the drive, and the ambition to do this. And I think the joint statement between the five football associations last night demonstrated that, as well as the statement from Prime Minister Johnson, and we'll do everything we can to work with the various football associations and with the British government to put our best foot forward. We will have significant competition for this, as you can imagine, Mary, from a European perspective, but also the international dimension as well. So it will need significant work over the coming period.
And elsewhere, of course, to horse racing, horse trainer Gordon Elliott dominating headlines for all of the wrong reasons after that photograph of him sitting astride a dead horse. What is your reaction to what we saw and to where this goes from here now?
Well, I was absolutely shocked, appalled and horrified by that photograph. It showed a complete and profound error of judgment, and it was really disturbing from an animal welfare perspective. I think everyone across the country and even internationally who saw that photo was shocked, and I think he has to be held fully accountable for his actions, and there needs to be, and I know there is an investigation by the Irish Horse Racing Regulatory Board, but it is important from an Irish perspective that we have the highest welfare standards. And someone myself who grew up with animals, and I think anyone, whether they did or they didn't, was shocked by that. And I think consequences are important, and he needs to be held fully accountable.
Fully accountable by that, do you mean up to and potentially including a ban?
I think everything should be on the table. I think Ireland has to set a high bar when it comes to animal standards. We're talking about a dead horse here, and I think I found everything that has been said so far doesn't explain what everybody saw, and I was really, really disturbed by it. And I think there has to be full follow through. And everything should be on the table to make sure there's accountability and a high bar set for anyone who wants to work with animals in this country.
The European Commission is to propose an EU-wide digital certificate which would provide proof that someone has received the COVID vaccine or that they've tested negative for the virus. Our Europe editor Tony Connolly is on the line with more. Tony, where's this idea coming from and how much support is there for it?
Well, Rachel, there has been a debate among leaders, EU leaders, about this. I mean, they discussed this when they had a video conference last week. And the idea has been around since January. At least in January, the Commission talked about some kind of interface that would allow national systems to interoperate with each other. But this appears to go further. This appears to be a dedicated EU electronic passport or certificate to show that you have either been vaccinated, that you had the disease in the past, or that you've tested negative. And in theory, then, that would facilitate travel around the EU for work or for tourism purposes. Now, there are kind of roughly two camps in this discussion. One is, by and large, the Mediterranean countries, who are really desperate to have to revive tourist seasons this summer, and they believe that a certificate of that nature would, you know, reassure people travelling and reassure their hosts that they're not posing a risk of bringing infections into the country, and that generally tourism sectors can open up. On the other side of the argument, people are worried about, the ethical question about this, and also the medical question. If you are vaccinated, does that still mean that you can't pass the virus on? And given that, you know, we still don't have vast numbers in Europe vaccinated, that could create, you know, a kind of a two-tier system, people who have the vaccine and people who don't. But of course, the Commission is saying, well, look, this would also provide details of whether or not you've had a negative test and whether or not you had the virus in the past.
Would individual countries be free to decide how they used these certificates?
Well, once the certificates are up and running, and this proposal is due in the next week or so from the Commission, then it would simply be an electronic record of your own personal situation, whether you've had the vaccination, whether you've had the virus in the past, or whether you've had a negative COVID test. And one assumes that, if member states are going to agree to this, and that would obviously have to happen as well, then there would have to be a certain degree of acceptability among each member state that they would accept people into the country if they have such a digital record. But again, you know, there are lots of question marks around this. I think the debate has some way to run on this.
Tony, thanks indeed for joining us with that. Our Europe editor, Tony Connolly, there.
Now, a search is resuming this morning for a man who went missing after a kayaking accident in Kildare on Sunday afternoon. Our reporter, Gail Conway, is here. Gail, what can you tell us?
Yeah, this search and rescue operation began on Sunday when a kayak overturned on the River Barrow. An alarm was raised after a man and a young child got into difficulty at Ardrey Lock, just outside Athy. A child was rescued from the water and treated by paramedics after getting into difficulty, but one person is still believed to be missing after the incident. Now, the multi-agency search and rescue operation has been continuing in the area. The search, which began on Sunday, was stood down on Sunday night and resumed again yesterday. Again, operations ceased last night and are resuming again this morning. So today, the Garda Water Unit is at the scene, along with local Gardaí, civil defence and local volunteers. And Gardaí have confirmed that conditions are clear in Athy this morning, so the search should be resuming and teams will be searching in the area again today.
103 Bank of Ireland branches, north and south, scheduled to close. Three of them are in County Wicklow. One of them in Rathdrum, where Bank of Ireland is the only bank with a branch. Bill Porter lives in Rathdrum. He also owns the local sports shop in the town, Avondale Sports. He's been speaking to Angus Cox about the branch closure.
The Bank of Ireland in Rathdrum has been there for a long time. We have a small post office. We have a credit union. But listen, I'll be honest with you. I think 70% of the people in the local area use the Bank of Ireland. I know they're talking about giving the business, the Bank of Ireland, to the post offices. The only way that that would work is that if the Bank of Ireland premises gives to the post office in Rathdrum, because then it'll be grand. You'll have a massive big premises. You can run your post office from the Bank of Ireland. When the Bank of Ireland closed for 4 months in the COVID-19 for 2020, like, I had to go to Arklow and Wicklow to do some of my business. Like, 50% of my business is cash and 50% is with the Visa machine and all. Like, I only have a small business. It's me and my wife who runs the business. So it's very, very hard. If you're going into Wicklow or Arklow, like, you may allow an hour and a half and you get into the bank and you drive in there and everything like that. I just haven't got the time to be driving 10 or 12 miles down the road. Instead of that, I'd be able to walk 2 or 3 minutes up the road and all to my own bank.
That's Bill Porter speaking there to Angus Cox. For more on the Bank of Ireland branch closures now, coming fast, of course, on the heels of the announcement that Ulster Bank is departing the Irish market, I'm joined by Neil MacDonald, Chief Executive of ISME. Neil MacDonald, good morning.
Good morning, Mary.
Is Bill Porter really spelling out there what you feel, that for people who have these cash-heavy businesses, the inconvenience he talked about in having to travel distances, but also potential danger in travelling with cash to bank in different locations, is highlighted with these bank closures?
Of course it is, Mary, and despite the fact that in the pandemic people have become much more familiar and regular in using tap and go and electronic transactions, the fact is that certain sectors like hospitality, like retail in Bill's case, takeaway foods, but also, for example, old people in general, there are various sectors in the market where online banking and tap and go banking are not going to be the solution. For example, in Sweden, where they've gone a long way towards getting to a cashless society, it was the inability of certain sectors like those of old people that has slowed it down. Yet in Ireland now, we find that our banking sector has become critically concentrated on three and now two pillar banks.
But you've seen the statistics from Bank of Ireland in the last 24 hours about the decline in use in the branches, down a half during the pandemic, a quarter before that. And they've said, you know, we're providing an increased service in the post offices, that will be available. Does that go, perhaps not all the way, but some of the way to filling the gaps you're talking about?
Of course, it mitigates the loss of parts of the banking network. The problem is for those businesses that are obliged to use it, it's not an optional transaction. You or I can, when we go into a shop, to decide to make a cash or a cashless transaction. For those business people who take cash and have to take cash, whether they like it or not, because their customers insist on it, it's not an option for them. And the being forced to travel long distances with significant amounts of cash is problematic for a lot of those businesses.
Do you know what is going to happen with night safes, where somebody with, as you say, in the hospitality business when it reopens, or in the cash-dependent business, they would go to a night safe now? Will those night safes still be there when the branches close?
We hope so. We have not been given any indication on what's going to happen. Night safes, they're obviously critical for those parts of the hospitality and public and business that do take a lot of cash in the evenings and don't wish to maintain that cash on the premises. In some cases, those businesses are precluded by insurance from keeping that cash on the premises. So the absence of a convenient or nearby cash box is actually going to severely impact those businesses.
Another factor for you, what's the cost of banking to small business? Do you get value for money?
Unfortunately, what we've seen over the last number of years, and this has tracked the decline in interest rates and the fact that interest rates are now negative, the cost of banking is very significant. I mean, we would have a lot of businesses that pay in excess of €5,000 per annum in banking charges. And the cost of handling cash in particular is very expensive. So the typical charge among the banks now for customers lodging cash is €80 per €1,000 lodged. That's almost a 1% charge for the cost of handling cash.
All right, Neil, thank you very much for joining us. Neil MacDonald there, Chief Executive of ISME, pointing out some of the difficulties of those bank closures for his members.
We are joined now by Tommy Gorman on the line. Tommy, I was asking you about these plans due to be announced today, but also the fact that the latest figures show that 1/3 of the adult population in the north has received a first dose of the vaccine. Those are quite impressive figures.
Yeah, Rachel, apologies for the communication failure. The scale of the vaccine rollout is creating momentum in Northern Ireland. Over 500,000 people have received their first dose of the vaccine. And, of course, trying to contain good news and keep discipline in addressing the ongoing challenge of the virus, they now become problems, very real problems. So say, for instance, this morning, the executive is now going to meet at 9 o'clock. They have the paper, they know the documents, they're going to rubber stamp it. And then it's up to the Speaker in the Assembly to give time to Michelle O'Neill, the Deputy First Minister, who will brief ministers on the actual plan. Now, I understand what's in it is a series of steps, no nail-down dates. All will depend on the ongoing progress in containing the virus. But certainly, you can look at, there'll be nothing spectacular done in any way before St. Patrick's Day, but after Easter, I think you'll see the gradual lifting of restrictions, and the momentum then will build towards more and more restrictions going. And I think the overall plan is to have Northern Ireland, in some respects, mirroring what Boris Johnson hopes to achieve across the water in England, to have a very different, much more optimistic setting come summer.
As things stand then, Tommy, this could mean that one part of the island is likely to be in a position to move far more quickly than the other part.
That's the reality, and that's all down to the fact that they had vaccines available faster and they have a very good infrastructure in rolling out the vaccines. Vaccine provision is the game changer. But it has to be said, Rachel, that once the European Commission is beginning to get its act together, the European Union is beginning to get its acquisition of vaccines on track, and you'll see, I noticed it here in Northern Ireland, you can smell the optimism here because of the vaccine rollout. You can see it in people's faces. You can see the queues outside the different centres. And you can see the different age groups. The 60 to 64 age group can this week start applying for their appointment and get the vaccine within days. And you will have that situation south of the border, maybe a month or two behind. But the change that I'm noticing here in recent days is quite dramatic.
Tommy, many thanks for that. Our Northern editor, Tommy Gorman, there.